Okay, we're live.
Let's broadcast start.
Good evening, everyone. I'm broadcasting live. Broadcasting live, November 19th, 2015. Today, I went to see the McMaster Hillel, which is a Judaism group. Nothing big there. I also had an interesting conversation with a Christian man. I may have been a little bit confrontational. He's really nice, you know, he's a friend of a friend, friend of one of my classmates. Making friends among the students here. And so we were sitting, I was eating lunch, and they were talking, and then after lunch, I started talking to him about. Well, I mentioned I was talking about meditation, and this classmate of mine, she started meditating, and I was saying how the mind isn't all that. Right, because we were talking about smoking, because they all smoke, and some of them are using this vaporizer, and some of them are actually smoking cigarettes. And so I asked one of them why he wasn't using, because he was complaining about it, and I said, why aren't you using the vaporizer? And he said he tried it, and it doesn't work. He's addicted to the actual act of smoking, the feeling of the cigarette. He prefers it. And so we started talking about conditioning, how you become conditioned to like certain experiences. And that led to talk about the mind, and I made a comment that the mind isn't all that mysterious after all. It really works in quite orderly fashion. And he argued, he said, I think there's some real mystery to the mind. Of course, he's Christian, and he believes in a soul. And so we launched right into a debate about belief, and that was an interesting talk. Interesting discussion. In the end, I accepted that his belief was understandable because it was based on his appreciation of the things he could find rational reasons for in Christianity. Like, meaning there are certain teachings that you can that don't come from, that you accept not based on faith, you accept based on empirical evidence, like in terms of the goodness. What I mean to say is what I said to him is we accept certain things on faith when they come from people who we respect, and so out of respect for people like Jesus, who he clearly said things that are worth listening to. Christians believe a lot of things that that maybe aren't they aren't easily understandable as being good, beneficial, true, etc. But they believe them to be good, beneficial, and true. Because someone who they respect as being good, beneficial, and speaker of the truth, because they come from that person. So I said, I can understand that. I think that's reasonable. You know, there's things about in Buddhism that I take on faith because I respect the place they come from. I think people would criticize that, but I think there's something to it. I mean, I'm obviously not saying that he's right. I think he's wrong, but it's understandable. And to some extent, that's an important point, because it is a way of discriminating between religions and religious teachers. You have to be sure that the religious teacher who you're putting your faith in is a good person. But I think many people want to go further than that, and there's an argument that should go further than that, is that you shouldn't believe anyone, right? It's not in your best interest to follow someone who has teachings that you're required to believe. It's in your best interest to follow teachers who are set upon allowing you to realize things for yourself. And that ultimately the argument from faith that in the end you just have to believe, I think, is faulty. The whole conversation was about how belief itself is unreliable, and you know, it's interesting because he seemed to think that faith was not. He was very slippery. He kept saying, "Well, maybe it is, and maybe it isn't." Everything I said was, "Well, maybe, maybe not." You know, what can you do about that? It's kind of this. You know, he wasn't as serious about it as I am. So he was being very slippery about it, on purpose, which was nice. It made for a non-confrontational dialogue. His father's a priest. But it's my point was that faith is it's this simple point that if you believe something, then it can turn out one of two ways. All you can say about it is it can turn out one of two ways, true or false. That's all you've learned. You have this statement. It says nothing about whether the object of your belief is true. I believe X says nothing about X. Says nothing about whether X is true or not. And he was kind of like, well, maybe it doesn't, maybe it doesn't, or, oh, I'm not so sure about that, or something. So, difference of opinion. That's why it's hard to talk to people who have different views. And Buddhist monks and arahants in the time of the Buddha would often despair of trying to teach people, such people. They would say, you have different views. If I teach you, it will just be a hardship for me. I'll just waste my time. They wouldn't even teach sometimes. And it's a good point, because sometimes you teach and you just waste your time. When people have attachment to views, that's what it ends up being sometimes. So, Robin, how are you?
I'm well.
I'm clicking here because I'm adding you to a calendar.
Oh, okay.
And Tina, no?
Yes.
So we're having meditators come to practice, to meditate, and we have to figure out how to coordinate, because I've just been saying, okay, come, and now I'm realizing, oh, wait, I can't do that. I have to let people know and stuff, right?
You have to count how many, because there aren't that many rooms at the monastery. It's too cold to have people stay outside in tents, I think.
Okay, there, I've shared the calendar with you, so now you can add people. And I mean, I think it was public calendar anyway, wasn't it? Maybe it wasn't.
Yes, the calendar is shared on ceremonglow.org under schedule, but if you actually share it with our personal calendars, then we'll see it right away. So I think that will work.
I don't think it's enough. I think someone still has to be told that there's such a meditator is coming.
Sure.
Because if it changes, then
what you can do is create an event, and that will send an email to each of us to accept, and what we're accepting is just accepting responsibility for doing ordering food or whatever. Pardon?
Will it automatically send to everyone who's subscribed?
Yes, if you create an event and you invite the people that need to know about the event so that they can make arrangements for food and so forth.
I have to invite you, that's what I have to do.
Invite them as an event, yes, and then we'll all sign up yes or no, and that just means that'll just be a trigger, just an email to us too.
Okay, but this is the thing, is I have to know who has to know, and I guess I have to be sending emails.
You have to let us know when someone's coming, yes, and then we'll take it from there.
Okay, so who do I let know?
Myself, Tina, and Aruna at this point. I think that would cover the basics for food and basics.
Okay. Would I mean, it would be nice if someone else was handling all that, like
Oh, I mean,
fielding
we have really
emails and
good
stuff.
volunteers. We just haven't really talked about that at the meeting as far as who would, who else would want to coordinate things and be involved.
Like if
But we
someone
can
could
bring
be
that up.
answering emails and
General inquiry, sure.
yeah. Because I'll forget. I will. Not very responsible.
Just need a couple of volunteer admins to help you out with that. Lots of small details, but we can do that. So I might be going to a mosque on Saturday for a prayer service, I
There's
think.
a vigil tonight in downtown Hamilton. I
Is
just
there?
found out about it this evening. They didn't send the email out early enough.
Well, I think I had told you in our town there's a mosque, and last weekend after the bombings in Paris, somebody went and shot two bullet holes into the door of the mosque. The FBI is actually involved. It's
Wow.
obviously a very serious thing and a terrible statement to make, against the mosque, and that's not the way the community feels. So
Yeah, it's
they had.
happening in Toronto as well. Sorry, didn't mean to
Yeah,
interrupt.
they had, I thought, a great response to it. They're not, trying to shutter their doors and make sure no one attacks them. They said they're opening their doors. They want to invite the whole community to go to the prayer service and to bring turkeys because we've got Thanksgiving coming up in America next week. So they asked people to come to the prayer service, bring turkeys, bring toys for a toy drive for Christmas. So I think I'll go.
Yeah.
Show support.
Yeah, it's happening in Canada. Muslim people are being attacked and threatened and stuff. It's kind of silly, no?
Yeah, it's ridiculous because, it occurred to me that this person who, shot holes into this mosque, and it was actually they said in the report that it actually shot through three interior walls into the area where people actually sit and pray. So this was presumably a high power weapon of some sort. So this person was, I assume, so afraid of terrorists that they would shoot into a mosque, which makes them a terrorist. They were so afraid that they actually became what they were afraid of. So very distorted. But
Maybe not afraid, they're sometimes just very angry and want to show that they're not afraid and they're gonna kill you. And I don't know. It's
what, doesn't that come
kind of
from
hurt.
fear, though?
Well, it can come from anger and arrogance as well. It's not always fear, I don't think.
But doesn't anger come from fear?
No. Does it?
I
I
thought you
mean,
said so.
fear is based on anger, but I think fear is a specific type of anger.
Oh, fear is based on anger. I thought anger was based on fear.
No,
Okay.
anger, well, I mean, they're just words, but anger is, I think, more the root. We always translate it as anger. Dosa is the root in the Abhidharma. Fear is dosa mula, is patiga, is based on aversion. Patiga is the essence. The essence is something called patiga, which pati means against, and ga means, it's like a conflict root, means.
Oh, okay.
So your aversion basically, patika basically means aversion. But there's many kinds of aversion. I don't think fear is the base. Like you're not afraid of pain, you just don't like it. And I think it would be inaccurate to say you're afraid of it. I mean, it's just words. It's interesting because fear, that's why fear isn't actually used. Because it's an inaccurate word. Fear probably has something to do with anxiety as well. There's anger and anxiety or something.
Definitely.
So, do you have any questions tonight?
I think we have some questions. Sometimes it feels like there is no way I am having any mindful moments, even though I am noting. Am I again just confused about what mindfulness means?
Possibly. I mean, I would look at how you feel at that moment. Usually doubt would probably arise, the sign that your mind has doubt in it. Some people have lots of doubt and it does get in the way of practice. So then you have to note to yourself, doubting, doubting. But usually when people say it doesn't work, it means they've stopped meditating. They started and then they stopped to check and see whether it was working, right? It doesn't work like that. You have to be mindful. You have to commit to it. I mean, there's no reason to think it's not going to work. It's not like it's going to be magic and you're going to see some sign and say, good job. You're on the right track, or only 10 minutes, only 10 miles left.
It's because we're used to video games and leveling up and
Right.
getting all those cues.
What are the video
All those
games cues?
signs.
Don't have any of those. So that's why I've always said, don't look for results, look for content, quality, you know, the quality of the moment. What is the quality of a mindful moment? That's what you should be concerned about. Once you feel the quality of a mindful moment, then you understand what the purpose and what the power and what the benefit of it is. You don't have to think about the future or how is it changing me. That's ridiculous. It would be ridiculous to think it wasn't doing good for you. Once you see how powerful and how pure one moment of mindfulness is, how could it do anything but good? And you have to dispel these doubts in that way, because they're ridiculous. We come up with ridiculous doubts like, well, I'm not getting anything out of this. No, that's not how you can't judge like that, because you can't see it, because you have so much delusion, because we can't see our own eyes, you know, you can't see dirt on your face. It's that kind of thing. You can't see your own defilement. Very hard to see. So, I mean, meaning you can't easily judge yourself or assess yourself. You can do it, but there's many problems associated with it. So it's an inaccurate or problematic means of assessing, you know, practice. And moreover, the act of worrying and doubting and wanting for some kind of spiritual enlightenment is a hindrance in itself. So you want to know whether it's meditation is working, and then look at how it works in that moment. What does it do in that moment? That's all you should be concerned about. So try it. When you doubt, say to yourself, doubting, doubting, or worry, when you're concerned or confused or whatever, note that and see how that changes your state of mind. Then you'll say, oh, this is good, useful. It's a worthwhile skill.
And it's from the same meditator. When I am noting, am I by definition having mindful moments? Just not necessarily any clearness or concentration?
In the beginning, maybe not, because a word is not mindfulness. But if you use the word to create mindfulness, to be mindful, to remind yourself, if it reminds you of the experience, the objective experience, then that's mindfulness.
I have been using your technique by using my senses and then saying to myself what I am noting, for example, rising, falling, seeing, feeling, etc. But there are so many things that I am aware of, it becomes just too much.
Mm.
For example, 1 minute I am concentrating on my breathing and saying breathing, but then I have an itch and say scratching, then I will start to become mindful, but then as soon as I'm mindful and have no thought, I start seeing things, for example, the bright color of the autumn leaves. So I say seeing, then I feel the wind in my hair, so I say feeling, but then I smell something, so I say smelling, etc., etc. And this can go on for a long time. Can you please offer me some advice on what I should be doing? And as when I am at a stage of having no thought. It seems I get wrapped up in everything I am experiencing.
No, you can note the overwhelmed feeling that there's too much to note. I don't know about noting breathing. That's not really what we teach. We teach watching the stomach rising and falling, which is a bit different. So you should, if you're following this technique truly, you should follow that. Why? Because that's a means of keeping you from going crazy, noting everything. You'll always have something to come back to, but it's not the breath, it's the stomach. So when the stomach rises, you should say to yourself, rising. When the stomach falls, you should say, falling. That does help you keep grounded, always having something to come back to. But when you're overwhelmed, you can just say to yourself, overwhelmed, overwhelmed. There's nothing wrong with noting things. We do try to note one thing until it disappears, not just once and then go on to something else. But that will also help keep you focused, if you note one thing until it disappears. But it doesn't sound like you're doing all that badly. I mean, you have to identify what is the problem with your situation. If you're jumping from one thing to another, then, well, it's a sign that your mind is not settled, which can be natural in the beginning, but it can also be that you're trying too hard to jump from one thing to another instead of being fixed on one thing, you know, like pain, pain, until it goes away.
What about the last sentence here? As when I'm at the stage of having no thought, it seems I get wrapped up in everything I am experiencing.
I don't understand.
I'm wondering if the meditator is maybe practicing a different tradition where you're not trying to have any thought.
Well, if you have no thought, you could say calm, calm, or quiet, quiet.
No, I think they're concerned that when they finally get to the point of having no thought, then they suddenly get wrapped up in everything they're experiencing.
I don't understand.
I think they might be talking about a different type of a technique. Although it does say, no, it does say I'm using your technique.
Are you sure? Have you read my booklet?
Yeah, as soon as I'm mindful and have no thought, I start seeing things. For example, the bright color of autumn leaves.
Oh, I see.
So. Yeah, so I think they're trying to not have any thoughts, which is...
Well, maybe not trying, but they can get to a state of no thought, but it's easy to miss that state and not note it. And when you don't note it, you can enter into high states of calm, which lead often to bright lights, even rapture, that kind of thing. So if you feel calm or quiet, you have to say to yourself, quiet, quiet. But if you see something, well, then you just say seeing, seeing. But try to say seeing until it disappears. Don't jump from one thing to another. Or try to note quiet until it goes, until it returns back to normal.
Hi Bhante, where can we read about the components of emotions?
Components of emotions. You're maybe thinking Abhidhamma. I would read the Comprehensive Manual of Abhidhamma by Bhikkhu Bodhi. Yeah, really good book. It's a bit complicated, but it does show you the essence of Buddhist psychological ethics, or the way the mind works ethically.
Hi Bhante, how do you deal with the passing of loved ones? Is it the Buddhist way to bring up past memories, or to eradicate them totally from our thoughts and focus on the moment?
What would you say, Robin?
Well, I don't think you can eradicate, you know, anything from your thoughts. Memories will arise, and you can note that you're remembering, but it's probably not wholesome to get wrapped up in things to, you know, I just see so many people in my daily life who are continually wrapped up in the past and just always yearning for things that used to be, people.
And you hear
used to
people
be.
Say, "Oh, I missed my opportunity." I hear that often,
yeah.
And they say, "I made a mistake. I did something, and it set me on this path." I've heard that, and you get the sense of this defeatism, or
yeah,
like they feel they're too late. They missed their opportunity.
or in this with the passing of loved ones, you know, just people who just never get beyond, you know, my mother passed away, or you know, someone passed away, and they just never get beyond that.
Right. I think my grandmother's like that. Her husband died, you know, it's like 30, 40 years ago now, and she's never really gotten over it.
Yeah.
She's lived like the day, that day, for the past 30 years.
Yeah.
To some extent. Maybe that's not fair, but hasn't moved on as well as some people.
So I would think from a Buddhist point of view, you certainly don't want to live in the past, but as far as eradicating someone from your mind, we don't have control over our minds. People will arise in our thoughts as they do.
In fact, trying to eradicate it probably gives it strength, makes it more persistent and more pernicious. Hey, wake up. Yeah, I'd say be mindful for sure. That's what Buddhists do. There are ways you can make yourself feel better about things, you know, do good deeds on behalf of the person who's passed away. Reflect on your own death. Reflect on death in general. It helps you realize that this is the nature, you know, clinging to things. It's not about loving people, it's about clinging to them. The problem is not that we love them. The problem is that we clung to them and are very sad that we no longer have that person. So we become dependent. We become this way about friends as well. You know, you ever have this feeling when you have to say goodbye to your friend and you just, you know, wish you could hang out longer, that kind of thing, you know? Feeling needy, clingy, people who feel clingy, or we all feel kind of clingy, you know, sometimes. Wanting to be around people, not wanting to be alone. Hey, when are you going to come and visit? That kind of thing. We're very needy in this way. That's recognizing that kind of thing is important. As it's suffering, you know? That's not a good thing. It's like an addiction. It is an addiction, right? Well, it leads to such stress, anxiety. People who want to find a romantic partner but can't, for whatever reason, they're just not able to, and they're constantly wishing and wanting and hoping and praying. Well, maybe not, but certainly it makes for suffering.
Regarding when people have passed away, do we know how long it is before people are reborn? Like, as you know, as people are grieving their lost loved ones, have their loved ones likely already been reborn into their next life?
I don't know. There's a sense, I mean, that's sort of the dogma that we follow, but it sounds like there are people who refute that claim. I mean, it's not really clear. But there's different ideas. You know, I mean, there's this whole idea of 50 days. I remember Brahma Wangso, this Australian monk, he apparently subscribes to the 50-day thing, or he's talked about it. And there was a monk at our monastery, this really pugnacious man. I think pugnacious is the word. It's funny, pugnacious actually means someone who likes to fight. It comes from Latin. We're just looking at the word pug. What is it? Pug something has to do with fighting, I think. A very confrontational sort of man, and he wrote an email, I think, to Brahma Wangso, yelling at him for being a heretic or something like that. Just ridiculous. I don't know.
So it's kind of different by tradition, or
well,
as far as the amount of time?
Yeah. I mean, not really, actually, because in most Theravada Buddhist traditions, they do a 50-day ceremony. And that's what Brahma Wangso was saying, was that they do, you know, in 50 days in Thailand, they have a 50-day thing. So everyone acknowledges this 50-day for some reason. It isn't in the canon, it isn't in the suttas, so there's no acknowledgement from the Buddha or from his Arahant followers or anything. But the tradition, the culture certainly seems to acknowledge 50 days. And then 100 days as well, whatever that means. I don't know. And they do a 1 year, of course, but that's more like an anniversary. But they do 50 days and they do 100 days, so take from that what you will.
Interesting. Thank you, Bhante.
I know the spirit can stick around. I think that's pretty much accepted. What that means is, because the idea is that the mind isn't created by the brain, but it's like living in the brain and it's obsessed with the brain. It's in fact you would we would say it created the brain, or it was involved in the creation. You have the sperm and the egg and the mind. Let's say the sperm and the egg and the mind coming together. And these are just one cell, I think, right? A sperm is a single cell organism, a single cell thing. An egg is a single cell. Yeah, that is true. And so it's very, very simple. And from that moment on, the mind is involved. It's not creating it, but it's involved. It's manipulating and it's affecting and it's being affected by. So that's why we're so stuck on this body, but we're not dependent on it. So the mind begins to loosen its hold on the body. And so that's how out-of-body experiences work. That's why near-death experiences occur. And when the body ceases to function entirely, well, the mind, there is an idea that it's still kind of, experiences are still related to the body. So it's, you would say, it seems like it's hovering over the body, that kind of thing. How long that lasts, my feeling is it's ridiculous for us to say 50 days. That's absurd to think that there's some law of nature that it has to be 50 days. And so I would, I'm not of that school. Don't know what Brahmavangsa actually said, but for people who say it's 50 days, I think, yeah, okay, whatever. I would
But
say it
even that's
depends on
a relatively short period of time.
your person. Yeah, well,
So.
not really. I mean, who wants to hang around a dead body for 50 days?
Well, I'm thinking as someone passes away and other people are grieving, people grieve for a very long time,
That's true.
and maybe it's comforting as you're in grief over someone who has passed away to think that, well, they're already on to their next, or will be soon.
I mean, I don't know. There is some idea that many people, I think there is a feeling, and wouldn't be surprised if many people did just immediately go to their next life. As soon as the body ceased, they would be on to their new life. In heaven, often that would be the case. They'd be reborn immediately in heaven. That kind of thing. So my guess is some people stick around. And maybe they stick around for 50 days, and maybe they do that because they know it's culturally important. Maybe they're conscious of this and they're really aware, okay, I got to stick around for 50 days because I know after 50 days these people are going to do a ceremony for me. And then on the 50th day they're like, okay. Because that's basically what Brahmavangsa was saying. He was saying, yeah, it must be 50 days because after 50 days everyone got a sense that the spirit was leaving or something like that. I said, well, so you could look at it the other way. Well, maybe that's because you were doing the 15-day ceremony for them.
So potentially you could be reborn, you'd be a baby, and be brought to your own 50-day ceremony under certain circumstances, possibly.
No. No. Not a baby. Because you're born in the womb and that's
Oh, that's
9 months.
right. That's right. So it that's right. You
The
would
one
need
year,
a
if you could come to the
you'd need one.
anniversary.
There you go. Full grown anniversary.
I was kind of flirting with the idea that I might be my own grandfather. My grandfather died in 77, and I was born in 79. So it doesn't quite work out because then that's 2 years, right? It wouldn't be a year. And so he died in February. I was born in May. So that's 2 years and 3 months or something. So subtract 9 months, approximately. You've got a year and a half. So there's a year and a half unaccounted for, which is not unreasonable to think that there was something going on for a year and a half before the mind was conceived. But you see, because I've always had a really close relationship with my grandmother, and I was always going to see her and going to Jewish synagogue with her. And we had some kind of, and when I became a monk, then of course she disowned me. And now she won't even talk to me. It was a big deal. I was going to become a rabbi. I was kind of, she was ready to buy me my own big Torah. So we went in California, we went to the yearly, it's called the Yahrzeit. A Yahrzeit is the yearly, every year Jewish people will light a candle for their parents and their spouses, I think. So my father, every year he has a special light that's like a candle, and he plugs it in for one night on his father's anniversary. And so we went, I went with my grandmother and my aunt and uncle and their family in California to this special Yahrzeit. So, well, it was the night at the synagogue where he was, it was his week, it was the week of his, so they would say his name along with other people's names. It's a thing. And I just thought it was funny because I thought, well, what if it's me? I don't know.
Is that something that people say, that people can be reborn into their own family?
Oh yeah, I think being reborn into your own family is a very common thing.
Yeah. Someone had said that to me at temple. They thought that their brother was someone, their uncle or something. And I didn't know what to think about that, but
you have to count out the time. So the Tibetans are big on counting out, and well, I mean, it's something that Buddhists think about. So you can count out time and figure out who in your family died 9 months before you were born. If it's 9 months, that's a pretty big coincidence. And then you have to look into it and see. I was named after my grandfather. What else? I mean, there's some coincidences that make you think, oh, maybe that's interesting. But, you know.
Yeah, it's interesting when people in the family have very similar characteristics and they never even knew each other. They're separated by years like that.
Right.
It's interesting. Hello, Bhante. Can insight meditation be practiced by watching the sensations of breathing at the nostrils?
Sure. It can be practiced when you're urinating and defecating. There was one guy who became enlightened in the latrine, looking at maggots in the, I think, it was looking at maggots that were in the cesspool. He became enlightened. There's many ways you can become enlightened. One man became enlightened when a leaf fell from the tree. So, insight meditation isn't dependent on the object. Now, the object has to be ultimate reality. So, I think the leaf falling from the tree isn't enough. There had to be something that had to spur him on, this person onto seeing impermanent suffering and non-self, which requires reality. So watching the breath is problematic because the breath going in isn't a reality. But at the nostrils, there is very much reality. There is the heat and the cold. So if you say to yourself, hot, hot, or cold, cold, or just feeling, feeling. If you note the pressure, the slight pressure at the lip, it's very subtle. And so it actually makes a poor choice of base practice for vipassana, because it's much more likely to lead you to tranquility, it being very subtle sensation. The stomach is much grosser. Like, the stomach is the breath, how it affects the body, right? The breath comes into the body. What does it mean to breathe? It really means, it's really down here more than here. I mean, this is just the entrance. So it really affects your chest and your stomach. Your chest for people who are tense, and your stomach once you start to relax. People don't like the stomach because mostly they're not relaxed, and so they can't find it because they're breathing up here. And you'll find, I remember when I was doing my beginner course, it was really difficult for me. And then one day my breath just went, and suddenly I was breathing from my stomach. It really does that. The tension leaves your body. Once you're relaxed, you breathe naturally. It's interesting. I have many students who would tell me they just can't find it. I say they don't. They just don't breathe from the stomach. I say, well, lie down on your back, and it's so revealing. So I have them lie down on their back right in front of me, and they lie down, and suddenly, lo and behold, they're breathing from their stomach like a baby. Which really is telling that we're very tense. We have this reflex tension when we just by sitting up. So you have to learn to be relaxed sitting. And you can't force it. It just has to eventually, you're just your body just releases, and that's good. It will do it by itself. You can't push that. But right. The point I was getting at was the stomach and this part is much more evident and easy to grasp. This one is too delicate. This is why it's used for tranquility, because it really does make you calm. You end up focusing on the concept of the breath much easier.
Dear Bhante, what are your thoughts on many people's attachment to food? I always think back to the story of the Buddha who realized he must eat to stay alive soon after achieving nirvana. He received a bowl of rice pudding, a dish that his mother made him as a child. I'm guessing this brought him great joy.
Well, a little bit of a let's get technical here, because that wasn't after he became enlightened. He realized that actually before he became enlightened. Which, I mean, it's not attacking you, but let's just be clear. As for feeling great joy, maybe. I mean, he wasn't enlightened, so maybe it did. But I think the texts would deny that, and teachers would generally deny that. Because there's a sense that even as an unenlightened being, he was very spiritually advanced. You got to remember as well, there's a guy who's experienced so much pleasure and then left it behind, and then spent a lot of time torturing himself. People who torture themselves, that's not quite fair to say. I mean, you've got a point. He could have given rise to this desire for the food. We have no record of that. But his taking food was the realization that food is necessary, and that food is actually helpful for spiritual practice, because puts you in a natural state, a state that is neutral, that is not out of sorts, that the mind is easily able to was familiar with and is able to relate to. Objectively. So you've got to get back to that state that is more or less natural or neutral to the mind. It's not to say you can't practice when you're starving, but because it's an uncomfortable or an unfamiliar state for the mind, which is unaccustomed to that, it can lead to a lot of distraction, and especially. He was actually practicing samatha first. The Buddha practiced quite a bit of samatha, even up until the moment of enlightenment. He had been practicing samatha for most of the night, and then in the end of the night, he finally turns to vipassana. But to get to all that samatha, you definitely need a strong mind, and you definitely need this stable mind that comes from eating food. So food is necessary, but your question is about people who are addicted to food? Is that what the question was about?
Just what are your thoughts on people's attachments to food?
That's just another attachment. I mean, the Buddha said all beings subsist on food. It was the what is one. Remember that talk I gave, the one Dhammapada, where Sariputta asks this Kundalakesi, what is one? I never actually said in the Dhammapada what was one. I mean, I think it sounded like I didn't know myself, but it's actually quite well known. What is one? Sabbe sattas ahare titika. All beings subsist on food. Which means it's a very basic basic interaction, so it becomes a very strong form of clinging, a very deep-rooted form of clinging. You find that out when you start doing meditation courses, taking 8 precepts, only eating once a day. It's hard to keep your attachment to food when you're only eating once a day, because the rest of the day these attachments arise and you have to deal with them and you have to live with them. And if you hold on to them, it's not a lot of, it's quite unpleasant to want a cheeseburger in the evening or pizza or whatever. Bread. A lot of Western people, there was this, in Europe they have very, very, German bread, for example. We had this German student and bread was a big deal for her. I can imagine, European people get very attached to their bread.
Who is reborn? Why should I care if I'm nothing but experience? Even if this mind is reborn in hell, so what? Or am I this experience, so there is a self in a way?
Self, huh? Is this person meditating?
Not today. Let's
Not
see if they
today,
have before.
Boo.
A little bit before, but not recently.
I mean, these are common questions. So let's see if I can put it to rest once and for all, so nobody will ever ask me this question again. Because I was thinking about this recently. It's this whole idea of abstraction. We have to be able to separate what we can understand empirically, what we can experience and verify empirically, and what we can't. What is an abstraction? Meaning the mind extrapolating upon reality. There's this weird thing that Locke is doing now, this guy we're studying, this philosopher. He's talking all about identity, and he ties himself in knots, I think, trying to explain identity. I don't get where he's going or why he's doing it, because identity is a concept, it's not real. And so the idea, is there a self, isn't there a self? I mean, most Buddhists want to say there is no self, and then that sends everybody into a tizzy, because then who am I, So you have to nuance that answer. The Buddha never said there is no self. And that's an important thing to say. It's important to qualify that statement by saying he never said there is a self, and he clearly denied anyone who said there is a self. And they say, well, there must not be a self. You're looking at it in the wrong way. Yes, maybe that's a correct statement to make, factually true, but it misses the point that the idea of a self or an entity in general has no place in reality. Reality doesn't work like that. Reality isn't of that nature. And so this is why free will has real problems, because the idea of free will requires an entity who has the free will. It's hard for us to understand, I know, and I'm not able to explain it because I'm human, right? But we know how experience. The point is, it's all really pointless. And many philosophers come to this. They're like, well, it may be deterministic. The universe may be deterministic, and mostly they want to say it's deterministic, materialists and so on. But I still have to act as though it's not, because of course you do, because it's not, I mean, look around. The mind, look at how things work. You can do all these experiments that show that the brain knows before the mind does, or the main brain. What you can do with interesting experiments is you can see that when we think we choose, which hand am I going to raise? I think I choose. And in fact, we don't. In fact, the brain chooses for us, and the brain tells us which hand to raise. There's only the sense, and so Buddhism only seems to allow for the moment of reaction. So if a person reacts with desire or intention, then they will raise their hand once the brain provides the impetus or the instigation. Or can react, say, with mindfulness or with aversion. With aversion means won't do it, or with mindfulness will do it. But even that, it's very complicated. It's tied up in past habits, but there's no sense of determinism. And I would say where free will requires something extra that is not there. It requires the idea of a self, which, it's going too far. It's abstracting from experience, which doesn't seem to contain any idea of self whatsoever. Determinism doesn't go far enough, because obviously there is the mind that is experiencing and interacting and in some way affecting the body as well. So it's somehow a middle ground, which often may seem like a cop out. You're not taking a stand and you're sitting on a fence, but it really is that. Determinism is trying to reduce. You see, a determinist, and you can see it by the problems they run into. A determinist runs into a problem trying to explain how the mind is caused by the brain. Can't do it. They can't do it. Anyone who says they can has no is deluding themselves and is willfully ignorant about what is being said and what is agreed upon in the philosophical community, in the neuroscientific community. You can't explain it. It's the hard problem, that's what it's called. They run into that problem. So determinism runs into serious problems. Also in regards to quantum physics. Some people deny it, but quantum physics seems to show, or can be interpreted to be showing, that the mind is the creator of reality. You can't even talk about experience until you accept in reference to an observer. So there's that, and a person, on the other hand, a person who posits a self, free will, some being that's in control, goes too far, and they have the problem of having to prove or provide evidence for a self, which they can't do. There is no evidence for a soul or a self. So keep those two things in mind, and you do get somewhere in the middle. That is, it's ridiculous, because that's how we experience it anyway. We don't experience a soul, and we don't experience it as being deterministic. Now, we often do err on one side or another, and usually we err on the side of free will, right? We think we have free will. We think we can, we think we are the ones raising our hands. We think we are deciding to do this and deciding to do that, and much of it is already decided for us in advance. So Buddhism takes this and applies what is useful and rational and beneficial, and that is reactions. So Buddhism looks at reactions and chain and works on the altering of reactions. So reacting mindfully. And it tries to avoid language like you react or you do, right? Because it's easy to fall into thinking there's a self, or going beyond what experience allows for. So, a good rule of thumb is to keep focused on words, or not focused, but restrict yourself when you talk about ultimate reality to talking about ultimate realities. Right? So, seeing arises, seeing occurs, experience arises, it occurs, and then it ceases. There's very little actually that you can say, which leads some people to think is incomplete and so on. I mean, Buddhism, the essence of reality in Buddhism is just six things: seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, feeling, thinking. I remember trying to explain this to a woman who follows Hinduism, and she would always talk about all these crazy experiences. Well, in the end, that's just seeing, hearing, smelling. And in the end, it was a joke between us. Anytime she would say anything, I said, well, seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, feeling, or thinking, it's one or the other. I don't think I've answered his question, but hopefully I've come close. Hopefully I've given some food for thought. What was the gist of the question exactly? What was the essence of it?
Who is reborn?
who is reborn was the key, right? So hopefully you're looking at that issue in a different way, and then I can give the definitive statement that nothing is ever reborn. There's no such thing as anything ever being reborn. When something arises, it comes out of nothing. When it ceases, it goes into nothing. And maybe not. Maybe that's too strong to say from nothing to nothing, but it arises, and there's no sense of it having existed before that time. So if you're thinking in terms of a space-time, that doesn't make any sense, because energy can't be created or destroyed, right? That kind of thing. But we're not thinking in those terms anymore. We're only concerned about how we experience it. An experience came from a non-experience. There was that experience was not. A moment before, that experience did not exist. So the experience, and from an experiential point of view, which is how we view reality, and you have to get that across, then the whole idea of who is reborn makes no sense. Experience arises and ceases. You can say that that's impossible. Look at experience. That's how experience occurs. Right? We're completely uninterested in physics, metaphysics, superphysics, any kind of physics. Quantum physics, we're only concerned with experiential reality, with empirical reality. We're the radical empiricists. And that's why I think Locke, I mean, I don't know, I'm not an expert, I don't really know where he's going, and I haven't done all the reading I'm supposed to, so just from what I have done, it's a bit odd. He calls himself an empiricist, but then he starts talking about identity. Like how you tell that something, how do you identify with your younger self? How do I say I'm the same person I was 10 years ago? And I mean, it's kind of a ridiculous argument because who cares? You never were a self in the first place, right? It's just experiences. But you see, when I say that, people still think I'm talking in terms of entities. So they say, okay, we thought it was a self, but now it's broken up into smaller things, what we call experience. No, it's a different way of looking at reality. Experiences don't say anything about self. They don't talk about it. Experiences are, well, you'd have to say they're non-self. We do say that. So we do talk about the idea of self, but we stop there. And the point is that the point of saying it's non-self, the point of saying impermanent suffering and non-self, is only to deny the fact that deny the idea that these things are permanent, satisfying, and controllable, or self. And deny that. It's not about they have something intrinsic about them. They are those things, meaning that they're not what we think they are. That's what it means. So it's looking at the world in a different way. In order to see non-self, you have to look at the world in a different way. So Buddhism believes in momentary death. That's how death occurs. The death of a being is just a concept. The human body, we know this from materialist physics, it's just particles or whatever is underlying the particles. So when a body dies, nothing actually dies. It's only biology that says it does, and biology is not ultimate reality. Nothing really happens when you die. Not essentially. The mind keeps arising and ceasing. Experience continues on, moment after moment. I think it was easier to understand in the Buddha's time because this was, of course, millennia before Newton, before Descartes, before the idea of a four-dimensional space-time. So they looked at reality empirically. They didn't have televisions, so they didn't have calculators or rulers or tape measures. Well, maybe they did. But they looked at reality from much more from a point of view of experience, I think. They still had a lot of delusions, it's true. But it was easier to appreciate this way of looking at the world. Anyway, I hope that gives you some food for thought. 10 o'clock, that was an hour. That's enough, no?
That was a quick hour.
Well, we did have some gabbing at the beginning.
We did, and some good questions and answers.
Have more questions? If there are more questions, you have to wait for next week.
Next week?
Next day. Tomorrow we have Dhammapada, so it could be for after the Dhammapada.
Okay.
I wonder what our Dhammapada is tomorrow.
Should be 110.
110, I think it's a good one. Okay, good night everyone. Thank you, Robin.
Thank you, Robin.
As for meditators who are coming, what's the next step? I have to email you all, or what do I
there,
do?
There's a basic application, so I will make sure that you have that.
And I have to send it on to them?
So you can forward it to the meditators, yes.
Okay. Can I have them send it to someone else? Oh no, what do I do with that? What do they send it to?
They should send it to you.
Oh right, I'm the one who needs the applications.
Yes.
Because they're confidential.
Yes.
All right. Okay, thank you. Good night.
Thank you, Bhante. Good night.